You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, at the Tour de France in association with RAFA, the fastest closing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with RAFA in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam. Stage 16, today within Nîmes.
Well, chaps, it's hot, isn't it? It's hot and sultry in Nîmes. I was going to say, where are we, Lionel? But I just said where we are.
Well, we're outside a very friendly bar where we recorded our press conference last night. And we've come back here having initially tried to record our podcast outside an Irish bar called...
But your people weren't very friendly there, were they, Lionel?
Well, they were not very Irish either, but...
no.
Yeah, I must say, I got a little bit angry, to say the least, you know, at these... unfortunately, as you might have experienced as tourists in the south of France, from time to time you come across, and I'm very sorry to say that's quite frequent, on some bartenders or restaurant landlords not very being polite and kind of pushing you away because the table is dressed for dining and you're not supposed to be having beer or that sort of a... This is unacceptable, you know. If that happens to you, just leave the place. And you'll find there's lots of friendly places as well. And it's, unfortunately, you know, having been a bartender, a restaurant owner myself, I know that these practices are rife and sometimes you don't take the Visa card or checks or... Just leave the place, you know.
Vote with your feet, eh, Francois?
Well, I've never seen Francois so angry about anything. And I'm wondering whether it's a combination of factors, the temperature. Francois has been wearing shorts this afternoon against his own very strictly enforced rules and regulations.
I think I said on the podcast over 39, that's the limit when, or over 41, I said, is the limit over which I it's allowed to wear shorts. So it's my last chance to wear them, actually. Well, maybe we'll talk about it later, but the weather forecast for the end of the week is terrible.
I think we're all wilting, aren't we? The Tour de France was wilting today in the heat. It was a sprint stage today, very fast finish by Caleb Ewan, the winner. The only thing faster than sorry, Lionel, but I needed to say that in order to make that is a neat segue into what I'm about to say. The only thing faster than Caleb Ewan today was the sale of Stacey Snyder's mugs.
Second
batch of cups went on sale today, and they sold out in 4 minutes. It's been getting shorter and shorter, the window of opportunity to buy one of her beautiful cycling podcast mugs, which have been sold at the Giro and the Tour, and will also be sold as well to raise money for good causes. On this occasion, the West Lothian Cycle Park, a new cycling facility in central Scotland, and also the David Carey Scholarship Fund, the memory of a young boy in Virginia who was a very keen cyclist and who very sadly died in June this year after a long battle with leukemia. A fund has been set up in his name to help young kids who wouldn't otherwise be able to cycle, take part in cycling activities. So two really good causes and a lot of money raised for them. And it's all thanks to you, listeners. And the response to the cups has been, well, it's been very gratifying, hasn't it? It's been wonderful to see the enthusiasm to buy them and to support the good causes and to own a beautiful object as well.
Well, the thing is, Richard, you said this earlier, but I completely agree with you. The way Stacey has kind of documented the making of the cups, and these are beautiful handmade objects. They're all, you know, individual. They contain the quirks of being an individual, unique, handmade product. And, well, the only regret is that she can't make enough of them, seemingly. I mean, if they sell out in 4 minutes, the demand is obviously there from you, the listeners, and we will hopefully repeat this.
Yeah, why not? So there's obviously demand there, and we're sorry for everybody who tried to get one and didn't, and we're very pleased for those who tried and did get a cup. Hope you enjoy owning it. On with the stage then, Lionel. It was a strange stage today, starting and finishing in Nîmes. Am I doing the tail of the attack? No.
You won.
Over to you.
Well, you're right, Richard. It was a strange day. For us, almost a second rest day in a way, or perhaps a first rest day, because we travelled over from Foix yesterday. So
Foix.
Our rest day afternoon
I've been saying that a lot today.
Quite truncated. We didn't get a lot of downtime yesterday. But today, with the stage going out from Nîmes and out into the countryside and back into Nîmes, it gave us an opportunity to have... Well, I had my first lunch in an actual restaurant since Brussels. Not eating in the motorway services or eating in the press room. That was a real treat after 2.5 weeks, I have to say. I had an omelette.
I thought this was the tale of the attack.
It is.
Not the tale of your day.
Story of my day. The race itself, I can summarise in a handful of sentences. There were 5 riders in the break. Lars Back of Dimension Data, Stefan Rossetto of Cofidis, Alexis Gougère of AG2R, Lukas Wisniewski of CCC, and Paul Auserlin of Total Direct Energy. They were out in the heat all day. They were caught with only 2.5 kilometres to go, and then came the sprint. And it was another impressive finish by Lotto Soudal's Caleb Ewan, who wins his 2nd stage of the Tour and Lotto's 3rd in all. He was ahead of Elia Viviani and Dylan Groenewegen and Peter Sagan. The big news on GC was that Jakob Fuglsang, lying 9th overall this morning, crashed with around 28 kilometres to go, and he is out of the race, and so everyone shuffles up a place on GC. Tomorrow, a more demanding stage goes from Pont du Gard up to Gap and the gateway to the Alps, as they say.
The fastest closing in a World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa. And a reminder, if you want to own a beautiful Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt or cycling jersey or casquette, go to rafa.cc and you'll find the Cycling Podcast range of clothing there. We will be awarding a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt again this week, at the end of the week. And we'll be looking for nominations of riders deserving of the Pedaleur de Charme award. So keep your eyes peeled and send in your nominations to us, please. Lionel, you mentioned Jakob Fuglsang out of the race. He's not broken anything, apparently. We saw him being delivered to the medical van near the press centre where he was scanned and so on. And there were scenes there with his wife waiting outside and a couple of TV crews trying to film what was going on. And she was getting extremely angry. I mean, it was very hot. I'm sure tempers were fraying as a result of that. But scenes, as I say, outside the medical truck. But I guess... Yeah. A disappointing moment for her and for Jakob Fuglsang, and not one that she really wanted to be caught on camera.
Of course not, but I can understand the other side of the story as well. We often see those images, don't we, on TV of a rider entering or exiting the X-ray truck, which is normally down at the near the press room, isn't it? And yeah, but if you're married to the rider who is going off to be checked, I imagine pretty uncomfortable to be followed by TV cameras, but that is the kind of goldfish bowl of the Tour de France, isn't it? And, well, it's part of life on the Tour.
I just realised, have we actually even introduced you properly tonight, Francois? Only at the start with the...
You haven't said... Oh, you said where we were, but that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that, Francois, because you spoke to Jakob Fuglsang's teammate at the finish.
Yeah, yes. So, well, actually, when... Obviously, as usual, when a crash happens to a rider, especially a prominent one, there was quite a crowd of our colleagues around the bus, not praying on the casualty, but just to get to know how bad he was and how it happened, because it happened quickly and we couldn't see it. So Lars Michaelsen, which is usually the guy we talk to, the team director, wasn't there because obviously he'd been to hospital or to medical checks with Jakob Fuglsang. So, well, we waited for his teammates to come back to the bus. I mean, most of them waited for him and tried to see what they could do to, take him out of trouble. But unfortunately, they were told to, go ahead and leave him behind because, they obviously realized how bad he was. And so I talked to Pello Bilbao, who was actually just behind Jakob Fuglsang when the crash took place. Well, this is what he had to say.
Seen the crash just in front of me, and 3-4 riders went straight to the barriers. We were crossing town, narrow roads, and also the asphalt was quite bad. He couldn't do nothing. He went straight to the barrier, and I think he has broken something in the hand.
A huge blow for the team, obviously.
Yeah, a bad day. If he doesn't move in the moment, for sure, he has something serious, and now important objective that we are not going to achieve finally. We are fighting there at least to try to maintain top 10 and gain some positions day by day, but now we are going to change objectives. obviously. He didn't have any doubts, or yeah, for sure he has something broken.
Peo Bilbao there of Astana, Basque climber, apparently on his way to Bahrain Merida next year to hook up with Mikel Landa, we believe. But another crash today was involving Geraint Thomas, the defending champion. I think that was missing from your tail of the attack, Lionel.
Yeah, we got
your omelette for lunch, but we didn't get Geraint Thomas's crash.
Well, true. It's significant, I guess, that the defending champion has been on the floor three times. But, I mean, it was, a very light one, wasn't it?
It was a strange one. It looked like they were going around a corner on a roundabout with a big curb, and it seemed like he pedaled down and hit the curb with his pedal. It flipped his bike right around, and he fell quite heavily and at some speed. It looked to me like it would be a crash where he's maybe not picked up a bad injury, but the shock of that will be something that he certainly feels tonight. And in these last days of the tour, the recovery is so important that, you know, it might just have a small bearing on how he recovers going into tomorrow's stage.
Yeah, but in the same time, you have these what we call in French the luck of the winner, and which means basically that when you're on form and doing all right, you crash and you know you don't hurt yourself. Whereas when you're on the downward spiral, you crash and you hurt yourself. And it was, you know, obviously the case with Fuglsang, two bad crashes. One, you know, put him out of the race. You know, Astana, would been doing so well for the whole season, all of a sudden, you know, coming to a kind of a crisis. And now, you know, obviously they'll be going for stage wins. I suppose their main goal now maybe tomorrow, as early as tomorrow, which is a good stage for them. Whereas, you know, Geraint Thomas felt a couple of times on the tour, fell on the Tour de Suisse as well, and reasonably, you know, without any serious consequence, which is probably, which could be seen as a good thing, you know.
Well, we can't continue without focusing on the stage winner, Caleb Ewan.
Well, let's hear a little sound from outside the Lotto Soudal bus, which I got to just after he crossed the line. So some sounds there from outside the Lotto Soudal bus. There were a lot of guests and VIPs there. They had a couple of sponsor announcements on the rest day, so maybe they were people connected with the sponsoring companies. They'll become Soudal Lotto next year. But there was champagne bottles being opened and lots of cheering for the riders as they return. They're having a really good Tour de France, aren't they?
And a belting Tour de France. That's the third stage win. Thomas de Gendt won in Saint-Étienne. Ewan's won in Toulouse, and again today they've had the polka dot jersey since Champagne Country on the shoulders of Tim Wellens. They've been very prominent in breakaways, and the win for Ewan edges him ahead of the other sprinters. He's the first one to notch a second win in this tour, and I think it was quite striking to see the overhead shot with Ewan not a bike length ahead, but well ahead of the other three who are all in a line, Viviani, Groenewegen and Sagan. And so you can say, you know, he's sort of head and shoulders above the rest in the final 200 metres, particularly when you consider that he's not got the benefit of a full-on lead-out train. He doesn't really need one. Today he came through, well, straight through the middle really, and was certainly the fastest. There was, you know, no dispute about that.
It's interesting because in his previous victory, he took the wheel of Groenewegen and went clear. This time, I haven't seen the details of the sprint, but it seemed to me that it just you know, made a sprint. He didn't even take anybody's wheel, just sprinted to the finish line. He was the fastest, which is even more impressive to win in different fashions. Of course, he looks a little bit, his style is quite reminiscent of Mark Cavendish's. I mean, even Mark Cavendish himself, you know, paid tribute to Caleb Ewan and saying our you know, similar in style they were, you know, like kind of a diminutive, not that powerful, but more based on velocity than on strength and power. And let's face it, in my opinion, these two victories, you know, we're expecting a lot from Caleb Ewan, as we said, you know, when he won in his first stage, his Tour de France debut was kind of delayed. I mean, he could have started like much earlier, but now with these two victories, he kind of established himself as probably the man to beat, you know.
Well, you mentioned Cavendish, and by a sort of quirk of fate, in 2008, Cavendish won in both Toulouse and Nîmes. He also won in, where was it, Narbonne and Châteauroux. Well, the Tour's not going to those places this year, but Ewan, you mentioned his delayed debut in the Tour de France, and if we think back, Richard, to our live event in London back in November or December 2017, Matt White kind of revealed that Caleb Ewan would be going to the Tour to make his debut for Mitchelton Scott in 2018, and then that didn't happen. He was really kind of left out of the lineup because of the focus on the GC, and that paved the way for Ewan to move to Lotto Soudal. So at the finish, I spoke to the boss of Lotto Soudal, Mark Sargent, and then his old boss, Matt White of Mitchelton Scott, just to get their thoughts on Ewan's second stage win. Can you explain how you signed Caleb Ewan? Because this time last year he was not riding the Tour de France because Mitchelton Scott left him out of their team.
I was quite sure that he would be one of the fastest sprinters for the future. It was a coincidence. I saw him and I told him what I thought about him. And he was triggered also by the team and doing it all for him. From there, it all came, and now he proves that I was right.
And you've had some big sprinters in the last 10 or 15 years, Robbie McEwen, Andre Greipel. True. Can you compare Ewan to those guys yet?
Well, he's different. If you compare, you have to compare with McEwen, because he's also very aggressive and looking for the wheels he wants, and normally he has them. Today he lost it, I think, and he made it all by himself up. So he started way too early for him, but he managed to get it. So, great.
He's almost a modern sprinter because he doesn't need a lead-out train of five or six guys.
Not really, but they were there. They were making the tempo, so he can do his thing, you know. He wants to do it by himself, not the train. And that's why he's so good in. Today, he didn't have the fastest wheel in front of him, so he went for it, and he won. That's, for me, the most important about today.
And how about Paris now?
Let it come. But we have some hard stages in front of us. Thanks.
This time last year, you guys had to make quite a difficult decision with letting Caleb Ewan go, a sprinter of his quality, because it couldn't fit into what you wanted to do. But when you see him win a couple of stages the way he's won them, how do you feel? What do you think?
Oh, I'm super happy for him. He's a great guy, and he's worked very, very hard to get where he has. And there's no bad blood there at all. It's a business decision, and you can't do both things properly. Lotto Soudal don't do general classification. Their primary focus is around the classics and around Caleb Ewan. So it was a great team for him to go to. We go on a different track, GC in all three Grand Tours, and also World Tour races in general, where every World Tour race we go to, we're competitive to try to win it. And now with a reduction of team sizes from 9 to 8, and sometimes 8 to 7 merit rosters, you know, trying to have a sprinter, a support crew, climbers doing GC, either do it properly, or if you try to do both things, it can backfire.
But it just shows that if a rider leaves and finds a team that can accommodate them, you start to see the best of them.
100%. And look, at the end of the day, Caleb had won everything but a stage in the Tour de France on our team. We had developed him since he was 19 years old in our development team, right throughout our pro team. He'd won in the Vuelta, he'd won in the Giro. So it was the last box for him to tick, and congratulations.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Thank you to Seb Piquet for reminding us to tell you that this episode of our Tour de France coverage is sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom. We've spoken in previous episodes to Dan Bigham of the Hoop Watt Bike track team, and we mentioned how stable the Watt Bike Atom feels. So we wanted to ask Dan what his experiences were and whether the stability of the Watt Bike Atom helped when trying to do efforts at maximum watts.
They've gone about looking at how force is applied throughout the bike and where they need to correctly brace that, and obviously it has quite a wide platform as well. So yeah, you're not getting rocking. You can do absolute full gas sprints and not worry at all about that. I think we did the Watt Bike 1K challenge. It's a Facebook Live video somewhere, and Johnny peaked at 2,100 on it and barely moved. Yeah, there's not an issue at all at that perspective. And just a couple of years ago, back when we were on turbos, I remember every time we were doing sprints, you have to go and shout one of your mates to go and stand on the turbo to make sure you don't rip your bike off or fall off or whatever. So yeah, it's absolutely rock steady for that. You cannot fault it one bit. The only frustrating thing about it is therefore it makes it a bit harder to take it around everywhere. So I can't really take it to go and warm up on everything else, which would be the dream, I guess, in reality. But every price, I think, is worth it for just having such a solid and stable indoor training tool. So it's perfect for us. And we have one set up in the altitude room as well, which is a bit nerdy for us. But again, it just means we don't have to worry. We don't have to drag bikes in and out of the altitude tent. It's just all set up in there. And because it's so easy to adjust, you've got sliding saddle, fore aft, up, down. Same again with the drop bars and the extensions on there as well. So everyone's positions can be on in seconds, which makes life really, really easy for just going in the tent and getting our training done ahead of heading up to Mexico in a few months' time.
To be honest, Rich, I can't say that I...
Hang on, why not? I could have told you that the watt bike Atom is stable when you're putting out 2,000 plus watts. We don't need Dan Bigham to tell us that.
I dispute this. I want to see your numbers, because these numbers sound paranormal, and I don't doubt the watt bike Atom. I doubt you. I did feel, though, even with my mediocre watts, that it didn't wobble. There was no, it was rock solid, very steady. And the other thing about it is that its footprint, so to speak, is very small. You can push it away into the corner of the room when you're done with it, and really takes up very little space whatsoever. If you'd like to buy a Watt Bike Atom, you can do so at wattbike.com, and you have until the end of July to get £100 worth of Sigma Sport vouchers with every Watt Bike Atom purchased. Go to wattbike.com/TCP100 and use the code TCP100 when you check out. That's TCP and the number 100.
Before the break, we heard from Mark Sargent of Lotto Soudal and Matt White of Mitchelton Scott. Caleb Ewan, as Sargent suggested, could now win on the Champs-Élysées. He's never finished a Grand Tour. This is the furthest he's ever been in a Grand Tour. He started four before, three Giri, and one Vuelta. He's never got to the end. And there were some whispers that he may pull out after today's stage, but that would seem silly now, wouldn't it, with this chance opening up of a third stage win on the Champs-Élysées. And he must be delighted to be here and to be in this sort of form, because to go to a new team, it was a really important season for him and for his team, because he was stepping into the shoes of André Greipel. Those were big shoes to fill, and very different riders, aren't they? He's very diminutive, Caleb Ewan, and he's a huge gorilla, André Greipel. But, for him to have had the season he's had, where he's won stage in the Giro and here, is fantastic for him and for his team.
Absolutely.
And you spoke to their new-ish manager.
Yeah, absolutely, John Lelong. And that's exactly the question I asked him. What next? I mean, there's a bumpy stage to gap tomorrow, which could... which could be very, very fine for Thomas De Gendt or Tim Wellens to keep chasing KOM points. And also, Lelong seemed to imply that the Caleb Ewan would go all the way to Paris, in spite of apparently very, very hot mountain stage. Well, we knew the mountain stage in the Alps would be tough, but apparently they're going to be very cold and stormy as well. So could Caleb Ewan survive this Alpine ordeal? Let's listen to what John Lelong has to say.
We know confidence is important for a sprinter. Do you think that now, thanks to these victories, it can go a level higher?
I think that the confidence is there since the beginning of the season. He has seen that we are totally focusing on those stage wins for him, and that the seven riders which are around him here at the Tour of France are totally focusing on him on all those sprint stages without exception, and that he was in the trouble in the stage 2 days ago, that we directly stopped all the team to wait for him, because we knew that just after the race day we had one more opportunity, and you saw that guys like Thijs Benoot, Tim Wellens, Thomas De Gendt, they were taking six guys to bring him back to the peloton and to be sure that he can survive this difficult stage two fois.
Finally, three short, probably stormy stages in the Alps. It'll be a matter of survival now for Caleb.
Yeah, no, it will be survival, not only for Caleb, I think, for a lot of people. But first, let's concentrate tomorrow. We have a nice stage. We have La Sentinelle. We have the Donil to gap. Maybe an opportunity for breakaways. We'll see. So let's take it stage by stage.
Final word on Caleb Ewan before we move on. I'll refer you back to Adam Blythe's interview with him, which was the first in our Adam Blythe interviews series. And it was really fascinating to learn about what a versatile rider Caleb Ewan was in his youth. You know, he's not just a pure sprinter. That's obviously his specialism now. But he was a guy who, as a junior under the 23 rider, could climb with the best of them. And he had a funny story about the World Championships, I think, in Florence, where the commentator confused him with a Colombian. he thought that he was a Colombian rider just because he was climbing so well, and he is quite diminutive. There's quite a lot of Colombians who are similar builds. So there's more to Caleb Ewan than just the final 200 meters of a race. So, you know, he's got every chance, I think, of making it to Paris and maybe winning on the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah, once again, going back to the Cavendish comparison, I mean, you remember how bad Mark Cavendish felt every time, you know, his climbing abilities were put into question. You know,
how could we forget? Mark Cavendish racing again today, returned to racing, or is it tomorrow? He's returning to racing this week anyway. Now, we've got an overall battle to concentrate on the next few days. We're not really sure maybe what to expect tomorrow. It's a sort of transition stage, setting up three huge stages in the Alps, really. Is it? I've lost track of the days. Tomorrow's Wednesday, isn't it? Mm. So then Thursday, Friday, Saturday are the big days in the Alps. At the finish today, I spoke to Javier Artecha, the coach at Team Ineos, who looks after Egan Bernal, among others. And I just wanted to get from him a sense of how Bernal is heading into these crucial stages, because there's been a lot of talk about, you know, have Ineos got it right in terms of having their riders come to the boil at just the right moment in these stages. Everybody knows this is when the tour is going to be decided, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Perhaps Saturday. Perhaps the tour will be decided on the final climb. Anyway, here's Artecha on Bernal. He's still such a young rider, this only his second Grand Tour, but he's in a very strong position in the final week. How is he physically at the moment?
Yeah, he's feeling okay, no? I think one of his strengths is the recovery. We saw last year as well, the third week, he was doing a really good job for the team. And this year is pretty much the same, no? He's feeling well. Recovery rest day yesterday was really good for him. This morning, he looks really, really well. So, looking forward for the last week.
Does he like the heat as well?
I don't know. It's something that we will find now, no? Maybe he didn't race too much with the heat, but he likes both when it's heat and also when it's cold. He likes both extreme conditions because he thinks that the race can be harder. And when you feel good, you want a hard race, no? It suits really well to him.
Saturday and Sunday, the mountain stage in the Pyrenees, was he performing there at the level you kind of expected from him?
Yeah, I think he was performing really well. If you see how strong the people was in the race and only the climbing, the power they produced and how fast they went, I think for him, he was performing really well. He had really good numbers. We are hoping to have the same in the third week here in the Alps.
I mean, altitude is a factor as well, and he comes from Bogota with 2,600 meters. Is that a factor in his favour this week as well?
We hope so. I think when the race is going up to 2,000 meters, it's going to be a benefit for him because, as you said, he lives at 2,700 meters elevation in Zipaquirá in Colombia. Quite a few kilometers this year in the Tour de France above 2,000 meters. So we hope it's going to be a benefit for him and he's going to perform really well at this altitude.
Can he win the Tour?
Yeah, why not?
Who's going to win the Tour?
I don't know. I think he's one of them can win and G as well. So for us, as long as we have the winner in Team Ineos, we are happy.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can get your 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. A reminder too that Science and Sport are running a fabulous competition to win a day in the Team Ineos team car at either the Vuelta or the Tour of Britain. It's your choice. You will also win £400 spending money, transport and 2 nights accommodation. There are some great runners-up prizes as well. And to enter the competition, all you have to do is go to scienceandsport.com/signup. That's scienceandsport.com/signup. Good luck with that. Now, I was mentioning the stages that we've got coming up, Lionel. A bit more detail on those?
Yeah, well, tomorrow's stage is a very typical stage to gap. We always know what's going to happen in gap. There's always a climb, what, 6, 7, 8 kilometres from the finish, and then a descent down into town. Could be one from the breakaway. Unlikely that the GC riders will be particularly active, not least because there aren't any bonus seconds on that final climb tomorrow. The next stage on Thursday to Valois is really difficult. It goes over the Col de Var, which is 2,109 metres, the Col d'Izoard, which is 2,360 metres, and the Col du Galibier, 2,642 metres. And there's a time bonus on the top before the descent down into Valois. That's a real difficult stage. Then on Friday, the stage goes to Tiene. It's actually pretty short, 126.5 kilometres. If you look at the profile, it's up all the way to the Col de l'Isérin. There's bonus seconds on that climb and then the climb up to Tiene at the finish, which is not that difficult, but coming as a summit finish, that will certainly, you know, whether we see action on the penultimate climb leading to that, well, we'll have to wait and see. And then on Saturday, it could, as we've been speculating all day, Rich, it could come down to the final kilometres of Val Thorens. Before that, we've got the Corme de Rosalind, and then the climb to Val Thorens is a brute. It goes up really for the last 35 kilometres of the stage, and the last 800 or 900 metres are probably not dissimilar to the new bit that they did on La Planche de Belfie in the first week. We were talking this morning to Dave Brailsford about the, you know, what are the tactics here? And when I was talking to him, he was saying the problem here is that Julian Alaphilippe is ahead, and he's the first nut that has to be cracked. They have to put him to the sword by setting a fast pace somewhere on the climbs. But of course, no one wants to do too much, because whoever cracks the nut, somebody else may greedily come along and then eat the contents of the nut ahead of them, to stretch analogy.
I spoke to Matt White this morning. He predicted that Alaphilippe will have lost over an hour by the time we get to Paris. He says the explosion is going to be huge. He says it's coming, mate. Interestingly, Alaphilippe apparently didn't go for a ride at all on the rest day, and he didn't do any press after the stage today, as is required by the rider in the yellow jersey.
I think they get a day off, don't they? They can make a discretionary application to the organisers to not do the media
that's
one
right,
day.
Yeah, the yellow
is
jersey
that right?
can do that. No, the stage winner has to go, but if the yellow jersey, if he stays in the yellow for a long while, I think it's more than 10 days, and maybe is it the case, probably, as, you know, can... say no to one.
Well, I didn't know that. Well, see, he skipped
anyway,
today.
Yeah.
It was also interesting. Dave Brailsford really tipped Mikel Landa. He said he's the one guy who has the ability to attack on a climb and sustain it and get away. Now, we've watched that and thought, well, is he being sort of allowed to get away because he's a bit further back overall? But according to Brailsford, it's you know, he has. He has a sort of ability that a lot of riders don't have, and he's still an outside threat.
This morning, I was talking with other journalists, to Magnus Burkhardt, you know, the Borahansgro German rider, which, you know, we all like very much because he's nice, talkative. I think with Peter Adesham, and we asked him for his one, you know, top three in Paris, and he said Mikel Landa. I mean, without any hint of an hesitation. So, yeah, obviously everybody has had the impression that we were always talking about Thibaut Pinot losing 140, but Landa also lost, I mean, as we
209.
Said, 209. Yeah, 209 in a crash. And he was one of the guys in the Pyrenees. I mean, there was Thibaut Pinot, obviously the most most efficient climber in the Pyrenees, but Mikel Landa was pretty close in terms of the results. I heard somewhere, I can't remember where, the list of who performed best in the Pyrenees in terms of time, and Landa was just behind Pinot. Well, obviously Simon Yates didn't do so badly because he won two stages as well. So maybe Alaphilippe is predicted to be the man on the way down, and Landa the man on the way up. And another very important factor, as I mentioned before, is that I had a look at the weather forecast, you know, to know how to dress in the since I wore shorts today. I'm afraid it's probably going to be the last day when I wear shorts, because storms are predicted towards the end of the stage tomorrow in Gap, and then the three next days, I mean the big days in the mountains, look to be absolutely grueling in terms of weather forecasts. Big storms, heavy storms, the temperature going down, and on the crucial day on Val Thorens, the maximum temperature scheduled for the time being is 12, and starting at like 6 in the morning. So I mean, if you're going to go to the last stage, or well, the last alpine stage, you know, take your anoraks and you know, winter gear, because it's going to be very, very, very cool and cold, apparently, plus rainy. So this could affect really the outcome of the race.
Maybe the weather gods are smiling on Thibaut Pinot, because we know he doesn't like the extreme heat. He wouldn't want to be climbing in this sort of temperatures, would he, today? Who knows? I mean, what's the possibility of a stage being shortened because of the weather, or even? Ah, oh, no, let's not speculate.
No, but I'm just contemplating the idea of the race for the win 30 years after 1989 and the closest finish ever. The race for the yellow jersey coming down to the final climb, and six riders maybe, still having a shot at winning. I mean, imagine, that could happen.
We'll talk about it again, and you know, because...
Well, we've got another few days to talk about it, haven't we?
But you know, I know the climb to Val Thorens very well, and all this valley going up from Moutier, because, as you know, I covered alpine skiing a lot, and it's a valley I know well. And once again, one regret we could have, apart from the fact that we missed Tom Dumoulin and Chris Froome on this Tour de France, is Primoz Roglic. Because as we go up to the Val Thorens, we go normally past Courchevel, and that's where you have the Olympic, you know, board, you know, for ski jumping. So I mean, it would have been in familiar terrain by seeing, oh, you know.
What's the connection between Primoz Roglic and ski jumping?
I don't know.
Curveball there. Are we doing your feature? Well, I know.
Outside the team bus.
Outside the team bus with
Nicholas Roach, Team Sunweb.
Nico, how was your rest day? Was it restful?
Very. I absolutely did nothing.
You didn't ride your bike yesterday?
Oh, of course, yeah, sorry. But that's included in doing nothing. No, we did an hour and a half in the morning. Actually, probably a bit less, but an hour and a quarter. Just kind of found a nice coffee place in the center and then kind of strolled back to the hotel. And the afternoon was more about, as stupid as it sounds, the last couple of weeks were so hectic that your suitcase just kind of slowly but slowly becomes a mess. So I just kind of took my time of reorganizing my rain bags and reorganizing the suitcase, making sure everything is nicely folded.
You're not going to need stuff out of your rain bag these next couple of days. Pretty warm down here. Are you used to these kind of temperatures? Are you comfortable?
Yeah, I love them. Yeah, I've never complained about the heat.
That's the French half, the Irish half, maybe, used to the rain. You've got it the best of both worlds, I guess.
Yeah, although, you know, I think your body does adapt. And as much as I've been living abroad for, I think, almost 20 years now, since I was 15, I think my love for the rain has slowly disappeared.
What sort of tour has it been for you? Because if Tom Dumoulin had been here, it would be a very, very different race for you guys. How are you kind of, managing that? Because you kind of have a free rein. Does it kind of lack a bit of definition sometimes?
No, not at all. The team strategy is very, very clear. It's every day we take it as a one-day race and we go for the stage with the better cards. So the strategy is more clear than ever. Obviously, it's a 100% different strategy if Tom was there, but the plan is clear. And the thing is, it's just not an easy plan to stick to. You know, when you go for stages, you find yourself fighting against some of the top riders who are also going for stages. And it doesn't mean when you try and win a stage that you're actually going to win one. Obviously, it would have been very different with riding in protection of Tom and making sure of keeping him in position, riding for him in the mountains. It's a very different tactic. Now it's all about using everybody's strength in the best way possible on the particular stage. For example, when there was four of us up the road the other day, well, Nick Yas and Case sacrificed himself to put me in the best position onto the climb, and then Michael took over on the second part to make sure that we were going to arrive together at the bottom of the last climb. most days I've been doing that work for Michael, riding in the front till 30k to go. There's not, nothing is about saving energy for the next day, because we're kind of trying to share the load and work as a team towards this goal of trying to win a stage.
You first rode the Tour 10 years ago. Has it changed much since then? Can you think back to 2009 and recognise the differences?
Yes and no, because I mean, cycling in general has evolved, not only the Tour. So, you know, I kind of, and it doesn't change from one day to the other, so it's kind of progressively changed. I think I've just kind of sunk it in without really paying attention.
I mean, 10 years ago, this would have been a skin suit type jersey. The jerseys in 2009 look almost baggy, and the bikes, I guess, have evolved. Does that kind of, that technology, I guess, you don't notice because it's always evolving?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That a couple of days ago, for example, I posted a throwback photo from 2010 when we did a Tourmalet. And I have the, you know, I have the little Speedo on the front with the cable going around the fork. My jersey is a little bit baggy. My sleeves were up to here, higher up than they are now. And I remember when I think it was Garmin at the time, came on the Champs-Élysées with the skin suits. And I was like, what's this about? And then now everybody's riding a road suit or whatever they name it. But it's very similar. But it's true. I think it was 2011. I think it might have been when the Garmin guys showed up with a skin suit on the last day. And I'm saying, what's this? You know, it's a short stage, but where are you going to put your food? And to be honest, once I've tried the road suit, I fell in love with it, because I've kind of broad shoulders, and I just felt that without having the Bibsharp stripes, I was able to breathe better.
And lastly, I mean, this Tour is so open. It's probably the most exciting Tour for almost 30 years. Do you notice that or feel that when you're in the race? Do you feel that it's an open race and anything could happen? And at the end, could you tell me who you think's going to win?
It's going to take a lot of energy over the next couple of days to get rid of Alaphilippe, but I still believe G can make it. Although I think today, the best climber in the peloton is clearly Pinot.
Oh, Nicholas Rotzer, your latest victim, Lionel. Which teams have you still got to do? You haven't done Ineos yet, have you?
Ineos, I haven't done Bora Hansgrohe, I haven't done Jumbo-Visma, I haven't done Total Direct
Energy. You have done Jumbo-Visma.
No,
you did Mike Tournesson.
No, that wasn't outside the team bus. That was something very similar.
Well, was it? Hang on, where did the interview take place?
Outside the team bus. But all interviews take place outside the team bus. But there's a very key distinction between doing an interview outside the team bus and doing outside the team bus. Okay?
But actually, taking Nicolò Roach as a victim to outside the team bus is a little bit like cheating, because every time you don't know who to interview, go to Nicolò Roach, because he's nice, he talks four or five languages. And
well, I wanted to do Wilco Kelderman, but he didn't start.
He's not here.
So
yeah, difficult, well difficult
well
to do
so,
him.
So, you know, and I tried to do somebody at EF Education First.
It's very difficult to get interviews at EF Education First, isn't
it? Well, it was this
Lionel.
Morning, because they arrived late. They had to get a police escort into town to get in time. They arrived with only about an hour to go, and that meant that they hadn't had their team meeting, and then they had to sign on, and I'll try them another day. But that would be ironic, wouldn't it, if I got to the end of the race and hadn't managed to have a word with somebody from EF Education First?
It would be, yeah. Well, finally, tonight, a colleague of ours from the Associated Press, AP, John Lester, tweeted a series of tweets this morning about his great-great-grandfather, a really quite incredible story, and a link between his great-great-grandfather and today's stage. And I thought I would go and ask him about it today when we met at the press centre.
You are a Frenchman and an Englishman.
A Frenchman and an Englishman, yeah, well put.
Tell us this story that you posted on Twitter today.
Well, I'm here at the race covering, you know, the Tour de France with the Associated Press, and it so happens that today they went up and down a hill where my great-great-grandfather was cycling back in 1948 from a football match in Alès, which the Tour also went through today. And on his way down the hill, he had an accident and suffered a fatal head injury. And so we were talking about this last night with, you know, Mum and other members of our family, and, you know, because they were all out there today, basically pretty much where he had this accident. And Raymond Ducasse actually has a very interesting sort of personal story. He was a French Protestant pastor, which is like a priest, during the war, and actually worked to shelter Jews from the Holocaust. So he was providing people with fake identity papers, fake baptism papers, and saved some Jews from you know, possible execution by the Nazis. Afterwards, in 1992, he was recognized by the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem as being amongst the righteous, so basically people who, non-Jews, who during the war had helped Jews in this very dark time in their history. And so, yeah, so we ended up talking about this, and it just struck me that that this is very much a story of the tour, because, you know, every day the race goes past some little thing that will mean something to somebody. It strikes me when, you know, we're driving on these roads and you see the little memorials by the side of the road of people who've been killed in car accidents or motorbike accidents. And this just today happened to be a story where a part where it happened to touch my family. So that's why I tweeted what I did. And it also turns out, just to make an even long story longer, that Raymond Ducasse's son, Robert, was in the French Resistance, and he was executed in 1944, while his dad was also, you know, as I said before, doing his bit too. And so it turns out that father and son are now both on the Yad Vashem Memorial for what they had done during the war.
So Robert would be your grandfather's brother?
Raymond Ducasse, who died in 1948, he was my great-great-grandfather, my mother's grandfather. Robert Ducasse was my great-uncle. It was nice today because Raymond Ducasse, his only surviving child is now 93, and she lives right next to where the race zoomed past today, and her kids came out to the race route, which is at the top of the hill where their great-grandfather was killed, and my mum's was down at the bottom of the hill. It kind of had a very personal feel, very personal sort of family sort of feel, you know, today.
Well, the tour does this, doesn't it? I suppose, as you say, it sort of shines a light on places, villages, buildings, hills, and puts them in the spotlight for a day, and allows these stories to almost have new life breathed into them.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, this is the only sporting event that actually moves around, right? You go to a football match, you're in a football stadium. The tour is going through people's lives, going through people's histories, going through people's towns, their villages, right past their houses every single day. And so basically it's a sporting event that goes right into your front yard, right into your house, right into your family history. And that makes it so unique.
And does it feel quite a special day then to be able to tell this family story again as well, and to remember it, I suppose?
It has been a special day for me today. And, you know, to be honest with you, I mean, this is a story that I've heard many times since growing up, but I've never really spent the time to, as I did today, to sort of really dig into his family history. And I hadn't actually realized personally that he was on this memorial in Jerusalem, or Robert either. And there's a very good little swimming spot that the riders actually should have stopped off today, which is about a kilometer away from his house. And when I used to go there as a kid every day to go and swim in this horrendous heat, I used to walk past Robert's. There's a war memorial there with his name on it. So he'd always kind of been present. Today sort of gave me a chance to sort of really dig into this story, and I was kind of surprised myself. So yeah, it has been a very emotional day.
And I saw you looking up old pictures on your computer there. You're writing a story as well. Where can people read the story?
That'll be on the Associated Press Wire and apnews.org, which is our website. And those photos are from my dad, who's kind of like a history hoarder of our family, who's been gathering together loads of photos. And it turned out when I sent him a message today, "Dad, you got any photos of Raymond and Robert?" And sure enough, he's got a whole bunch of them. So hopefully they'll be on the story as well.
Well, as John Lester said, a very typical sort of Tour de France story, but a lovely story and a precious day for him and his family, which was nice to hear about. We should wrap things up, shouldn't we, fellas? Head for dinner.
Head somewhere. For dinner in Nîmes. We had a lovely dinner last night overlooking the amphitheatre in Nîmes with a few colleagues from the press room and roundabout. This evening, I'm quite keen to have something, just something nice and simple, relatively early night before we move on again for these final few days in the Alps, because, well, the tour is all coming down to the last few stages now, isn't it? So we need to recharge our batteries a bit, and I feel that Nîmes has allowed us to do that.
It's been lovely, yes. You know, bar the odd bit of bad service, it's been a very pleasant, you know, 40 hours or so here, hasn't it, Francois?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, Nîmes is quite a nice little town. I mean, if you come in the area, I you know, actually last night we had dinner in at the top of a new museum called the Musée de la Romanité. If you're into the Roman era and you like, you know, archaeology and all these, you know, antiques things, that, I mean, we know the Nîmes arena and all the monuments in the town, but this new museum is apparently absolutely you know, gorgeous, and the restaurant was quite nice as well.
I was just going to mention a theft in the restaurant last night. We all ordered our starters, and Richard and I had ordered the same starter, buffalo mozzarella with some local tomatoes and a little bit of pesto. And, well, Richard's eyes always dart round the table when the starters arrive, and he encouraged Francois to steal my starter. But what was amusing
swap
was
swap them, just swap them.
Swap the starters, yeah. So I had a smaller portion. But what was amusing was that then Hannah Troop, who you may remember co-hosted the Explore series with me last year and is now working for EF Education First, she swooped in to swap her even smaller starter with the one you'd stolen from me.
Yeah, it backfired horribly, that, actually. And
absolutely.
I was left with a very meager starter indeed.
Totally.
So once again, yeah, if you come to Nîmes, avoid the restaurants I kind of mentioned. There are very nice ones, and once again, try the Musée de la Romanité. It's a great place. You're just in between Montpellier, which is a great place, and Arles, which is also a brilliant place to come and visit. And if you're into, you know, this kind of southern atmosphere, Mediterranean atmosphere, and you like, you know, what I call old stones, you know, this kind of monuments from the past, you'll have a great time. A listener kind of taunted me saying, given the stage today, we'll be going through vineyards all day. Can you recommend wines? And he mentioned Costières de Nîmes, which is the wines in the area of Nîmes. We had actually Costières de Nîmes Rosé last night, which was quite good actually. But to be honest, if we're talking about red wines, I'd go more for the wines in the Montpellier region, like Pic Saint-Loup or the Minervois, you know, made of Carignan going to Carcassonne, or even you know, the red wines nearer to Arles. If you go to Arles or Saint-Rémy-de-Provence or this area, try Henry Millen. That's great ones as well. But of course, if you go for rosé in Nîmes, not far from Nîmes, there's a little village called Tavel, and it's probably the most famous rosé in the world. So there we are. You know, the little wine lesson I was supposed to be giving, it's just been given, and I'm going back to my beer.
Well, yeah, hopefully we'll have a nice bottle of rosé tonight. We're in rosé country and rosé weather, isn't it?
It sounds like Nîmes is about to kick into party mode. A band is about to start playing here. There were little bandstands around town last night, so live music was kind of drifting through the streets. Very pleasant.
I like this city a lot, yeah. Before we go, I was darting around today on my Austin Cycles Atto folding bike. If you want to win one of those, sign up for our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com, and then through the newsletter you can enter the competition. Tell us why you should win this bike. It's a beautiful carbon fiber folding bike, and we'll read out a few more entries for that tomorrow night, I think. Before we go, some thanks to friends of the podcast, and a reminder that you can sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. The most recent episode was Lunch with Dave Brailsford. There's lots more episodes to come, including audio diaries from the Giro Rosa by Taylor Wiles and Lizzie Banks, who won a stage there. That'll be coming soon, and I think lots of other episodes exclusive to Friends of the Podcast coming as well. My thanks to those who've signed up recently: Timothy Main, Nigel Hartle, John Lyons, Jonathan Lewis, Seb Ramsey, Anderson Schneider, and Jenny Craig.
Grand merci à Nat Henderson Cox, Michael Quettle, Joe Trickett, Lee Chapman, Jonathan Cutts, Nicholas Russon.
And a big thank you to Susan Taylor, Michael Stewart, Adam Nash, Susan Ross, Paul Dinning, and Sarah Raw.
Thank you, fellas.
Thank you, Richard. See you tomorrow. Well, see you now, but also tomorrow.